BP still acknowledged that these are projects they were probably going to do anyway.
BP announces significant new investment in the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Air Force recommends downsizing Eielson Air Force Base.
There's a lot of opportunity here, and it's almost like they ignored all that and just said, well, you know, we got to check the box, get the EIS done, let's just do that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Today, BP committed to spending at least $1 billion in Alaska over the next few years. The oil giant plans to use that money to bring two drill rigs to Prudhoe Bay and to potentially expand into the undeveloped parts of that field. The announcement comes on the heels of a major change to the state's oil tax system. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Over the past 3 years, one of the biggest criticisms of Governor Sean Parnell's plan to lower taxes on oil companies was that those companies weren't making any commitments to drill more in Alaska. Since the overhaul passed, producers like Repsol and ConocoPhillips have said they're going to invest more in the state, and they've given the tax cut credit for that. Now, BP is the latest company to join the chorus. Here's spokesperson Dawn Patience.
That change in the taxes really allowed us to move forward and get the support of the working interest owners to move these projects forward.
Patience says that BP will be adding 200 jobs to their Alaska operations just to bring on the new drill rigs. She says that BP is also working with Exxon and ConocoPhillips to start building up the western part of Prudhoe Bay, which could mean more than 100 new wells in that area. BP can't say how much new oil these developments will yield, but the Parnell administration's applauding the announcement, and the Department of Revenue says the new rigs are good for the state treasury. During the oil tax debate, the department was estimating that the legislation would cost the state at least $3 billion in lost revenue over the next 5 years. Oil tax advisor Mike Pawlowski expects that number to go down substantially with BP's new rigs.
The fiscal note we always put out as worst case scenario with no new investment in new production, and this is obviously different. We're seeing significant new announcements. So I think overall it's very exciting.
Not everyone is celebrating BP's announcement. At the end of the legislative session, Democratic lawmakers who opposed the oil tax cut said they expected to see lots of brass bands and ribbon cuttings for work that was already expected to happen. Bill Willikowski, a senator from Anchorage, says that BP's announcement is part and parcel of that.
Shame that the governor gave away billions and billions in tax breaks to get something that the oil companies were going to do anyway because it's so profitable.
Willikowski adds that one of BP's Alaska executives already acknowledged that some of the work that they're planning to do would have happened anyway, just at a slower pace. BP will be putting contracts for the rigs out to bid this summer, and they expect the first of the two to go online in 2015. Spokesperson Dawn Patience says that the company is not factoring in a referendum to repeal the new oil tax system in its investment decisions. That referendum could be on the ballot next summer while the rig work is underway. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Major hurdles need to be cleared before Galena residents, who evacuated due to a major ice jam flood last week, can return home. KYC's Dan Bross reports.
State, community, and tribal leaders are working together to help Galena recover from last week's big flood. Alaska Deputy Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management Mike O'Hara says a lot needs to happen before Galena can handle an influx of people.
It's still wet in the community. There's a lot of hazardous materials, some oil spills and the like. Our issue at this point and our concern at this point is to make sure those in the community that are still there are safe and well taken care of, because they're starting to work on the process of identifying some of the damages.
About 70 of Galena's 400 residents and members of a government response team remained in the village last week, as all but a few high spots were inundated with water and ice that damaged and destroyed many buildings, flooded the community sewage lagoon, and caused numerous fuel spills. Governor Sean Parnell declared Galena a disaster Friday, activating access to state relief funds for individual and public assistance. O'Hara says the immediate challenge is repair of basic infrastructure.
Getting communications out there so people can call in and call out. The power system is being restored right now in certain areas of the community. The roads are washed out and destroyed, some of the main roads, so we have to get those back up and running. DOT's in place right now working those things, so there's a lot of action going on in Galena right now.
O'Hara says a regular schedule of flights will be set up this week, so evacuated residents, many of whom are staying in Fairbanks, can return home, even if it's just for a day at a time.
To make sure people can get in there, look at their property, assess what's damaged, take pictures, record whatever they need to do to get critical documents back that they just took off in the evacuation, get that critical information back for them, and either shelter back in Galena or come back here to the shelters.
O'Hara stressed that the flood response is a cooperative effort with the community, tribe, and service organizations. The Tanana Chiefs Conference has taken a lead role from the start. TCC Health Director Victor Joseph says getting out accurate information to Galena flood evacuees scattered in several communities is a top priority.
How do we coordinate the services, give people the access to assistance that they need, keep communications open and everybody well informed?
Joseph says the flood disaster is more than just a tribal event, and TCC is working to help everybody from Galena. A resources fair was held in Fairbanks Friday, showcasing a range of services available to flood victims in Fairbanks. Galena evacuee Shirley Cleaver says many had to leave on short notice and are starting with nothing in Fairbanks.
They don't have the resources here. They don't have a car. They don't even know the church to go to. They don't have no IDs. I left with these shoes and that was it, and no wallet, no purse, no nothing.
Cleaver says most evacuees are still processing what happened and just beginning to assess what they need to restart their lives. She urged those displaced to be thoughtful as they move ahead.
Be grateful for the people who stayed and just be patient with the whole process, government process, of whether it be declaring it a disaster or getting FEMA or whatever we're going to do. But just be patient and totally watchful on your spendings, because we're in this for a long road. We're not going to go right home. And people who have full-time jobs there don't have those anymore. And how do you live in a city when you don't have that income that you're accustomed to?
A number of organizations are stepping up, accepting donations of clothing, supplies, and cash to aid Galena flood victims. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska natives move to the Matanuska Sioux Sitna Valley.
They definitely know who we are and where we come from. They say they're Valley Eskimos.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A draft environmental impact statement released by the Air Force on Friday recommends downsizing Eielson Air Force Base for cost savings. But Alaska's leaders argue the document ignores requests for cost reduction estimates, among other things. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
The long-awaited EIS offers three alternatives. Two explore the impacts of moving the 18th Aggressor Squadron from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson near Anchorage. The third includes no action. But U.S. Senator Mark Begich thinks the Air Force should have considered the benefits of keeping the F-16s where they are.
First off, they're adjacent to some of the best training ground in the country when it comes to the air capacity there. Along with that, the Army is now looking at that space or additional partnerships with the Air Force. There's a lot of opportunity here, and it's almost like they ignored all that and just said, we got to check the box, get the EIS done, let's just do that. And I think that's a really disservice to our military, honestly, and to the people of Fairbanks.
According to the Air Force, moving the F-16s will result in significant cost savings. But the Alaska delegation argues the move will actually cost money as the Air Force struggles to find appropriate housing and accommodations for both the aircraft and associated personnel. Matthew Felling is the communications director for U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski.
We have yet to see anything that is not red ink from this equation. Secondly, we know in Alaska that the Asia-Pacific region is heating up. And the nation knows that the Pentagon has decided that this is going to be our focal point to take a look west. Eielson is in the pole position for this new philosophy. So why are we taking a look at undercutting it and short-sheeting it at a time when we should be building it up?
According to the EIS, the move would result in the largest increase in unemployment in the Fairbanks area in the last decade. It would also force the closure of two schools in the Fairbanks North Star borough and increase noise pollution in and around Jaybear. A group of state and local leaders who call themselves the Tiger Team have met regularly in Fairbanks for more than a year to discuss the Air Force's proposal. Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says the group is also unhappy with the draft EIS.
It's still the House of Cards perception that is very, very disconcerting to me when we see here's a document, doesn't have all the content that we expected to have in it, and in 10 working days, you'll have a public hearing.
Public hearings on the draft are scheduled in Palmer and Anchorage on June 17th and 18th. Hearings are also scheduled in North Pole and Fairbanks June 19th and 20th. Local leaders and the Alaska delegation say that's not enough time. The Air Force will accept public comment on the document through July 31st. A final record of decision on the proposal to relocate the F-16s is expected this fall. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
About 35 Carpenter Union locals in the Pacific Northwest have closed in the past 3 years to join larger locals. Earlier this month, Juneau's Carpenter Union Local 2247 fell to the same fate, and its members have been absorbed by Anchorage's Carpenter Union Local 1281. The Carpenters' umbrella union, the Pacific Northwest Region Council, says Southeast has not been forgotten. Council officials met with members in Ketchikan and have plans to open a Juneau office. Lisa Fu has this report.
May 1st is the unofficial Labor Day in the U.S., a day for unions and locals to celebrate their unity and strength. For about 150 Southeast Carpenters, who are members of Local 2247, it was the day they found out their hall had been shut down.
I actually saw on Facebook.
Juneau carpenter Chris Diamond has been a member of Local 2247 for 10 years.
I followed the Pacific Northwest Regional Council page, and there was an announcement that two halls in Alaska had been closed, so I clicked it to see what it was, and it was our local.
Diamond currently works for Juneau-based North Pacific Erectors and has never used his union local to find work, but he's been a loyal member, attending monthly meetings and taking part in union events.
For me, personally, that was kind of a kick, you know, when we're supposed to have this brotherhood and, you know, this tight-knit community amongst ourselves, and then to just have that taken away without any forewarning or any real clear explanation of why it was being done.
Local 2247 has been around since 1939. It was part of the Alaska Regional Council of Carpenters until this past February, when that council dissolved and was absorbed into the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, which represents 26,000 members in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and now Alaska. Ben Basim is communications director for the regional council. He says shutting down the Juneau local and moving its membership to Anchorage is part of a nationwide effort by the United Brotherhood of Carpenters to streamline operations, run more efficiently, and save costs. Basim claims savings have even been passed down to members.
The immediate benefit to the membership was a reduction in over-the-counter dues. I know, for example, my old local, I think I was paying $33 a month over the counter, and all dues went down to $20. So right there, out-of-pocket dues were reduced.
Basim says dues may go down for the Alaska members, but it's too early to say for sure. Southeast Carpenters are struggling with potential changes that may come out of the closure of Juneau Local 2247. Juneau carpenter Mike Vanderjack says it initially caused a lot of confusion.
about exactly what that would mean for us, you know, if they were taking over our retirement, or we just had no idea what that meant because they had not discussed with us previously. You know, maybe if we had had a few months to prepare ourselves and to understand what that meant for us, it would have been something different. But instead, it was just, you know, upsetting, confusing.
Without a local union hall, members also fear losing their voice. They once met in Juneau. Now monthly union meetings are in Anchorage. There's concern Southeast-based carpenters will have to share Southeast jobs with their Anchorage counterparts. Their concerns were great enough earlier this month that Juneau Senator Dennis Egan's office heard complaints.
Right now it just feels like we don't get a say in what's going on. And, you know, that's really upsetting. And it goes against, you know, everything that we've learned about what a union is.
Basim is hoping the Pacific Northwest Council can make the transition as smooth as possible. He wants to assure Southeast carpenters the council's intent is not to abandon Juneau.
Transitions sometimes can be frightening, and I completely understand that. But as far as the standard order of business, such as finding jobs and having contractors and dispatching members to work, it is not going to change. It's going to be business as usual.
The carpenters may be settling into the idea that Anchorage Carpenter Union 1281 is now their local. A union election is underway, and one member from Southeast is on the ballot. The Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters is also opening an office in Juneau and is currently looking for someone to work as a Southeast representative. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Around this time last year, it looked like ADAC's jet service was in jeopardy. Alaska Airlines wanted to stop flying there, and it was only after much back and forth that they conceded to continue serving the community on a trial basis. Now the uncertainty appears to be over. Alaska Airlines was the only company that responded to a recent request from the Federal Department of Transportation for bids on the community's essential air service contract, and they've agreed to commit for 2 years. Marilyn Romano is the airline's regional vice president. She says Alaska decided to bid even after the news that Icicle Seafoods would be shuttering its processing plant on the island because other companies and industries are poised to make up some of the traffic.
None of us can predict the future, but people in the community of ADAC feel like there are some possibilities for growth, possibly even in the oil industry. So we take all that into consideration making the decision.
But Alaska Airlines' commitment to ADAC in the face of an uncertain future will come at a cost. The company is asking the federal government to increase their subsidy for the route by $500,000 for a total of $2 million a year. Romano says that factors in the loss of passenger and cargo revenues from the processing plant and potential increases in the price of jet fuel. For its part, ADAC appears to be fully in support of Alaska Airlines' proposal. City Manager Leighton Lockett says continued jet service is critical to the community's development. The DOT will review the bid and is expected to make a decision about whether to award the contract in the coming weeks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The Federal Subsistence Board announced on Friday that the Copper River Subsistence Salmon Fishery will not open on June 7th as previously scheduled. Eric Veach with the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park says the salmon run is slow in coming back, so federal fisheries managers are delaying the opening for 3 days.
So what we're doing is we'd like to make the federal opening consistent with the state opening. We have two fisheries that occur really in the same stretch of river, and there's two different user groups, and what we like to do is we like to, whenever possible, have the federal openings consistent with the state openings, because that really makes it easier for the enforcement folks. If we have the two user groups fishing at the same time, it really reduces the confusion there.
The Copper River is considered a federal navigable waterway, and fisheries there are managed by either state or federal officials. The federal subsistence fishery in the Chitna sub-district will open on June 10th at 12:01 a.m. A group that wants to convert Fairbanks's dormant Polaris building into an indoor produce growing facility isn't giving up. Project leader and executive director of the locally based Alliance for Reason and Knowledge, Robert Shields, says he's organizing a campaign to raise money to buy the 1950s-era hotel and do initial renovations for hydroponic farming.
The project is developed into three phases. And the first phase, which we're working on now with the $2 million initial budget, is called Occupy. And that is essentially where we're going to be in the first two floors, put a new roof on and start farming so we can, as soon as possible, within the next year, potentially be actually growing food there.
Shields says the second phase entails a lot more money, renovation of the rest of the 11-story high-rise and leasing it to farmers. He says the ultimate plan incorporates renovation of the Polaris Annex and making the entire facility a showcase of sustainability.
Bringing together all of these concepts of sustainability as far as processing water, energy, and waste on site and doing a mixed-use commercial development that may or may not include additional farming elements.
Shields is hosting a public meeting sponsored by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation on the vertical farming project. It's one of two in the works for the deteriorating Polaris, which is owned by Anchorage developer Mark Marlowe. Marlowe wants to turn the old hotel into apartments, but has also offered the building to Shields. Both renovation plans hinge on complicated webs of private and government financing. The Fairbanks City Council recently gave Marlowe another few months to get financing together. The council had earlier set a March deadline for Marlowe or to see the building condemned. For over a decade, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough has outstripped the rest of Alaska in population growth. From 2000 through 2012, the borough increased by over 34,000 residents. That 58% rate is nearly four times at that of Anchorage and the state as a whole. As part of our ongoing look at culture in Alaska, Len Anderson discovered one group that's finding the Matsu particularly attractive is Alaska Natives.
A little over 5 years ago, Billy K. Lee moved directly from Kotzebue in northwest Alaska to the Matsu Borough. The mother of three elementary-aged girls never considered living in Anchorage, although her first job was in the city and demanded commuting for a year.
Here in the valley, it just seems a little bit more put together for me. Everybody is just right here. We go out somewhere, you see somebody you know, and whether it's from daycare or from work or wherever, it's kind of such a small community. You always see each other, communicate, intertwine with each other, kids play together.
The last U.S. Census shows the Alaska Native and American Indian population of the Matsu jumped by more than 60% from 10 years earlier.
No matter where I go, you see somebody that either looks like from home or they are from home. I have some girls from Norvik that live out here. There's actually girls from Notak that live out here that I know. There's just so many people out here that we know. I can count probably at least 100 that are just from home alone, meaning, you know, the Nana region.
It's not altogether surprising if the Kinnick area resident encounters a lot of familiar faces. Inupiaks now outnumber all other native groups in the Matsu borough. But even with all those folks from home, Billy Kay says teaching her daughters traditional knowledge and skills can be challenging.
It costs a lot of money for me to bring them home, at least $1,000 per child. And you know, when you work full-time and you raise three kids and you play sports and you do all kinds of other things, you have a mortgage, truck payment, you just don't get to go home every other month and do stuff that we need to do to harvest food.
Her parents and relatives do bring traditional foods from Shungnak and the Upper Kobuk. Overall, Billy Kay thinks her children are developing their cultural identity.
We kind of teach them the sense of who we are in different ways and kind of use the resources that we have out here, you know, to kind of bring it together in whatever way we can. Every day, though, I don't talk any back to them because I'm not close enough. You know, I don't hear it every day, so they obviously don't hear it every day. but they definitely know who we are and where we come from. They say they're Valley Eskimos.
It was after Lillian Lewis's kids were grown and her parents had died that she moved to the Valley.
It was good. I got to raise my boys up there, and they got to know our family.
Lillian comes from Kotzebue. Her husband, Larry, from Rhinelander, Wisconsin. They're sitting in the backyard of their home on a hill not far from Kinnick Goose Bay Road. Beyond their gardens, berry bushes, apple and pear trees, is an unobstructed view of Pioneer Peak and the Chugach Range. For 17 of their more than 40 years together, they lived in Kotzebue, where Larry relished his time spent hunting, trapping, and commercial fishing. In the late 1980s, Larry was hired for construction work at the developing Red Dog Mine. That was followed by a mine job, which meant a weeks-on, weeks-off schedule. They had some friends in the valley, and in 1992 purchased their present home.
For warmer weather. It was too cold up north, so I decided to go south.
Larry, who is now retired, had lasted only 6 months living in Anchorage. The city noise got to him.
I didn't want to live in Anchorage after living in the village. I wanted to get out of town. So when we moved out here and bought this house, my kids would come out from Anchorage and say, "Dad, what are you doing living way out here?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "It's so quiet." I said, "That's why I live out here."
Then, too, there was all that hunting and fishing the valley offered. Like Billy Kay, Larry doesn't regret moving to the Mat-Su, despite changes he sees that come with the population increase.
It's a good place to live. The hunting and fishing was great, but I see it disappearing. But we love the valley, and this is, I think, probably where we're going to be until the Lord comes back or we go to meet him, you know, one or the other.
With that observation, Larry sought shade from the hot May sun, while Lillian scurried toward the garden. For APRN, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Len Anderson in the Mat-Su Valley. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.